Good morning. So last time we talked, first about cache blocking, which is this cache optimization idea for cases where we're working with matrices or arrays. And well, the idea was, well, rather than relying on sort of our natural way we'd write code to iterate over that matrices or arrays, we choose subsets of them to work on that fit in our cache, and we'd reorder our operations to work on one of those subsets at a time, and then move on to the next subset. The name cache blocking comes from calling those subsets blocks, like in a matrix. They typically look like a rectangular shape. And when we're working in that subset, we'll have very good temporal and spatial locality. And this is a way we can get temporal and spatial locality where our natural orders might end up having some really bad spatial or temporal locality, at least in some of our dimensions we're working in. It's kind of the general transformation is that we have some loop that goes for all ij and, you know, whatever other index variables we have. We're going to transform that to choose a starting ij and then a range starting with that, those indices to work on. We'll do everything we can for that range. And because we're doing that, we'll have better spatial locality. We're trying to work on groups of values that are all together at once. We'll have better temporal locality because before we move on to different i's and j's, we're trying to do everything with the group of indices we have now. Yeah. Rather than our naive solution, which might end up sort of doing something with a particular index and then not going back to it till much later, even if there's some operations we could do soon. So questions on cache blocking. Okay, so then we moved on from cache blocking to talk about optimizations that were to do with running instructions themselves more efficiently rather than using our cache more efficiently. And the big one we came up with was this loop unrolling idea. So we take some loop that, it has some loop, and we transform it by making several copies of the loop body. And to make that work, we need to change the indexing. So we might change a plus equals 1, in this case, to a plus equals 3, and adjust things accordingly. And this improved our performance because, well, it turns out when we compile that loop to assembly, a bunch of the instructions, especially if our body is very simple, a large portion of the instruction might be the bookkeeping for the loop, the things that handle comparing values, jumping back to the beginning, adjusting our indices. And by doing this transformation, we can not duplicate that code and just have our loop have less instructions to run. Now, a problem is that, well, for this to work, if I'm making it I plus equals 3, now I need to handle the case, what if our number of iterations isn't a multiple of 3. I need to write code, to handle that. So we have some sort of code to handle leftover. This is going to mean that, it probably doesn't really make sense to do this loop unrolling idea for loops that, typically aren't run for a very large at least a somewhat large number of iterations, where that book leftover handling code is going to be a lot of the work. But for big numbers of iterations, it should be pretty helpful as far as reducing the overhead of loop, assuming that was a large portion of our work. And we looked at the performance of loop unrolling, and we found out, great, it helps performance, but we also had cases where we did more loop unrolling, we were running less instructions, and our performance didn't improve. And to start thinking about what was going on there, we said, well, how does the sort of processors I'm running these things on, how do they actually execute code? And you mentioned, well, these processors, they can start multiple instructions per cycle, and they run instructions in a different order than they appear in the program. They're out of order. And we started looking at what the hazard handling for that looks like. And that's what we're going to pick up today. So questions about these things we covered last time before we continue on looking at what that hazard handling for out of order look like. Okay. So mention for out-of-order processors, say for running instructions, you know, in some other order, probably because like values don't come from the cache soon enough, we have new problems. So in the old processor, we had, you know, an issue where we had to get the right version of R8. So if we're running ATTO 12R8, we have to make sure we get the version of R8 from the ATTO 11. We solved that problem by just saying, well, we know whatever's in execute, that's more recent than whatever's in memory. That trick no longer worked for our out-of-order processor because, you know, the way we'd start instructions, we couldn't rely on that type of information. So the solution we started with is that we're going to track the different versions of the registers explicitly. So we kind of did this implicitly in our pipeline processor. We know we have a different version of executed memory. Here we're going to track them explicitly by giving them kind of different names. And so what I did for that is I'm going to say, rather than saying this is add R10 and R8, this is add R10 taking the version 1 of R8 and producing version 2 of R8. And our second one takes version 2 of R8, produces version 3, and so on. And by keeping track of these versions explicitly, we'll just match directly. Oh, if I'm running the add from R12, I need version 3 of R8. If I don't have version 3, can't use it, do it. And that's the one I want to forward, that's the one I want to read. So another thing which comes up when we're thinking about this sort of version number idea, you know, different versions of registers, is that we also have cases where we're going to want to actually store, you know, for later, two different versions of registers, not just forwarding, but storage. So in this example, it seems like I haven't computed the value of RAX yet. And that's a bit of a problem because I have this first R move Q instruction, which wants to use this, the version of R8 from the add. The second R move Q instruction, which wants to use a different version of R8 from this R move Q. And also, I have this add instruction I want to run, which wants to use a version of R8 from this IR move Q. So I have instructions that I haven't run yet in my out of order processor because, well, you know, I want to run instructions as their values get ready. Like maybe we have to read RAX from the memory and that's taking a while. Maybe we have to read R13 from the memory and we're waiting for that. So I have a bunch of pending instructions that use R8, but they don't use the same R8. They use all different versions of R8. And this is a scenario we want to work. We want to be able to have the maximum flexibility for when we run instructions. So our solution is going to be that we have to keep track of multiple separate versions of this register. So this problem is known as a write-after-write hazard, where we're sort of writing over, you know, writing over the new version of the register with old ones, if we do the natural thing. And a solution pattern that we can use for this, that's probably the most common way out-of-order processors are implemented these days, but not the only way we could do this, is that we're going to have lots of extra registers, and we're going to assign each version of a register a new real register. So we're going to have tons of real registers, and we're going to assign each version a new real register. And so some terminology here, we're going to call the registers we see in assembly architectural registers. Architectural because they're part of the instruction set architecture. We're going to call the actual registers that implement them physical registers. And in our scheme, each version of an architectural register is going to have a different physical register. And after we do this renaming, all our hazard handling is going to become much easier. We'll use this not only to deal with, you know, making sure we have the right version of R8, we'll also use it to figure out when we can run instructions. Because the way these physical registers work now is either the register's value is ready and we can use it, or it's not. We don't have to worry about we have a value in the register, but it's not the right one. So we can figure out what instructions we can run by just saying, are the registers ready? We don't need to check did the prior instruction run explicitly, that's going to be checked by knowing if the register it wrote to is ready, because the registers are all written to once in this scheme. And in a typical implementation, on a sort of with modern numbers, we often end up having, for even though we have like 16 architectural registers, we'll have like hundreds, well, over 100 physical registers per core to implement this. Okay, so we know this basic scheme, the registry naming. Let's look at the pipeline for a typical out-of-order processor kind of design we'll have. So many of this looks kind of similar to our old processor. We have our instruction path. So this is our fetch stage at the beginning. So we have a fetch stage. And then we have a decode here. This decode is not like our decode. This is not register read. This is actually figuring out what the instruction means. So the register read happens much later over here. Something you might notice about our fetch stage is I've labeled branch prediction, and some of our branch prediction is going to occur before we actually read instructions. So typically, a modern out-of-order processor, they want to fetch lots of instructions in advance. They're fetching like 4 or 6 instructions at a time, and they need to figure out what instructions to fetch, preferably before they actually decode and process the instructions. So usually some of the branch prediction will happen before instructions are read, and they'll implement this by having like a cache-like data structure that says, here's where a jump was last time, so it can predict, oh, I need to fetch instructions that go to this location rather than just the next thing in the program. Also, there will be some branch prediction that uses the decoded instructions. So after we figure out what the instructions are, we have this renaming step. So here is where we keep track of the mapping from architectural to physical names. We also are going to do some bookkeeping with this thing called a reorder buffer to handle cases where we need to do things like squashing. We might also have some other ways of handling squashing that I'm not showing. But we're going to do a bunch of bookkeeping here, and this is where we're going to figure out how to translate our instructions into the versions with the physical registers. Now, once we have instructions with physical registers, we're going to have a queue, a list of the instructions that we could run. We're also going to keep track of which register, which physical registers are ready, meaning which ones have the current values in them, and the ones which don't, we have to run some instruction to fix that. And basically what we're going to end up doing is we're going to scan through this instruction queue, checking the registers each instruction needs, and figure out which ones can we run now. And once we find ones to run, we're going to send them to the next parts of our pipeline. So we're going to have our actual register read phase, so this rest of it, this is kind of like our normal pipeline so here. So we're going to read registers. In this case, we usually are going to be trying to run several instructions at once. Start them at once, not just run them, different parts of them. So we're going to read registers for 3 or 4 instructions, ideally, which means that our register file might have like 6 or 8 read ports. Then we're going to send these values to a bunch of execution units. So unlike our processor, we're kind of going to say we have like an ALU, or separately we could have like the data cache access ports here. So where we do memory loads and stores would be another option here. And typically we'll have sort of specialized tracks here. So like we might have sort of only one slot that supports complex ALU operations, where we have a slower ALU and some other more general slots. Just because if we think of our programs like, if we want to do integer divide, for example, probably we don't care about running 3 integer divides at a time, but we might care about running 3 adds at a time. So often our processors will be built where we'll have the machinery like to do 3 adds at a time, but we'll have only one thing that can do an integer divide, and we'll have to take this into account when we figure out what instructions to send out of our instruction. Then when we get the results from these execution units, doing either arithmetic or some memory operation, we're going to write back the values to our physical registers. We also have this final stage I called commit. Sometimes you'll see it called retire. And this is going to handle the bookkeeping for finalizing the instruction. And there's two big things which happen here. So one thing which happens here is that this is where we handle things like freeing up physical registers. So at some point, you know, we're giving a new name for each version of like R8. If we keep doing that forever, we're going to run out of physical registers unless we do something about it. And what we're going to do is we're going to have to figure out when are we not using an old version of R8 and free up that physical register. This is where the logic for that's going to be. This is also where we're going to do bookkeeping to handle things like undoing mispredicted instructions, or if we have a seg fault, getting your debugger the information about what happened just before the seg fault. We're not going to go into sort of the detail of how this stage works, but you want people to know, why is it here? Why is it a separate stage? So questions about our pipeline stages for this out-of-order processor. Okay, so let's look at the operation of this renaming step. So our renaming step, we're going to have to keep track of some information. So one piece of information we're going to keep track of is we're going to have some table mapping the architectural names, the names in the assembly, to the names the processor is actually using. And just to make things clearer in our slides, I'm going to call the physical registers things starting with X, and I'm going to use our x86-64 assembly names for the architectural ones. In the processor, probably these would both be represented with numbers, of course, not actual names. So we have this mapping saying currently, RAX is stored, the current version of RAX is stored in X4, the current version of RCX is stored in X9, and so on. I'm also going to have a list of available physical registers that aren't being used right now. And I'm going to use these when I need to store a new version of a value. I'm going to choose a new register for it. This is where I'm going to get the new registers to use. Okay. So let's go through our instructions one at a time. So for our very first instruction, I want to add from R10, which is going to be X19, and R8, which is going to be X13, and I need to put the result as a new version, so I'm going to choose a new version, which is going to be X18. So this is what I'm going to end up doing. So I chose X19 and X13, just looking up R10 and R8 in the table, and then I said, I need to write the result to a new place. And as part of doing that, I said, well, I need to write this instruction in a way where I can separately specify the source and destination, because those are going to have to be different registers in the scheme. That the way we're using our physical registers, I write to them once, I don't overwrite them. The only way they're overwritten is when I figure out they're no longer being used and they're freed up in that commit stage. So I need to rewrite my add instruction as one which has a different source, different sources and destinations. I can't have a shared source destination, and that's what I end up with. And I also need to update my bookkeeping information to note that, well, X18, not free anymore. And also, for the next instruction, if it wants to use R8, it should use X18, not X13. Questions? Yes.
So is X13 free?
Question, is X13 free? No, because this instruction that we just renamed needs it. So when is X13 going to be free? We have to know that there's no instruction that's currently in our processor using it. So if we think of going back to this diagram here, right, as long as I have instructions here or here that might be using X13, I can't mark it as free anymore. And the commit stage is going to need to do the bookkeeping to figure that out. Probably how it's going to work, it's just going to watch for instructions that overwrite X, that use X13 based on comparing them to what instructions exist and figure it out based on that sort of information. Or I guess, like, more specifically, it would probably watch for this instruction we just renamed. We would know that that would be the last instruction using X13. And it would watch for that finishing and everything before it finishing. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Was the register map arbitrarily chosen?
Question was, the register map arbitrarily chosen? So, yes. And probably the way this would work is the processor would have like some initial value of the register map, which would probably be like X0, 1, 2, 3. But this is going to like change just based on what instructions you run in a lot of ways. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So then we look at our next instruction. So we need R11. That's X7. And we need R8, which is now X18. And I need a new version of R8. So I'm going to use X20 for that. And I'll get like so. So I update, say X20 is not used anymore. We need to cross off X18 and put X20 because that's our new current R8. And then I repeat this process. So now I have an R12, that's X5. X20, I need a new version of R8, which is going to be X21. Questions about our renaming process so far? Okay, so done some simple instructions. So let's talk through a little more complicated example. We're going to think about some instruction types we haven't looked at yet. So the first instruction, same as before. So we have R10. That's going to be X19. R8 is going to be X13. I'm going to need a new version of R8. It's going to become, in this case, our first free register, which is X18 in this list. There we go. Then we have RMMoveQ. So we want to figure out what registers this RMMoveQ read from. Well, it's going to be R8, which is X18, and REX, which is X4. And you might say, OK, so it writes to REX. Well, no, it doesn't. It writes to memory. So I'm going to notate this like so. And I'm just noting for our bookkeeping purposes that this instruction writes to memory. Obviously, that's not actually a physical register. It doesn't have a number. But we actually do need to worry about the instruction writing to memory in this out-of-order processor. Because if we think about it here, I have two instructions, that one which writes to memory and one which reads from memory. And we want to run these instructions in a different order. And we have to worry about what if the value this first instruction writes, this RMMoveQ, is the same one that this MRMoveQ reads from. It could be the case that that's true, that RAX and 8 plus R11 have the same values when those instructions run. And if that's the case, we better make sure that the MRMoveQ reads the value we just wrote, even if we want to run the instructions in a different order. And this is something that out-of-order processors need to deal with. And there's basically two solutions to this problem that are common. So one solution is that we can say, well, since I need to worry about this load using the value that was just stored, I'm going to run the loads and stores in the order they appear in the program. I'm not going to do that part of the processor out of order. So that's one option, is I can say, if the instruction depends on memory, it needs to actually run in the original order. That works, but it turns out that that's really slow. So out-of-order processors don't do that. Instead, what we can do instead is we can compare the load and the addresses that are loaded and stored to figure out if there's actually a conflict and then handle that conflict in some way. And the second option is what almost all current out-of-order processors implement, even though it is pretty complicated. We're not going to talk about the details of how to implement that in this class. That's a graduate architecture topic, probably. But that's sort of what goes on. We want you to be aware that that's something which needs to be handled. But for our renaming, I'm just going to note it uses memory, and we'll worry about someone else implementing the part of the processor that handles the conflicts that result from it. So questions about memory case? Okay, so then we have a subtract. This subtract is actually straightforward. We read from R8, which is X18. You write to read from R11, which is X7, and we need a new version of R11. And I'm gonna choose my next free register, which was X20, and update what R11 is, write my subtract. Then I have an MR move queue. I read from R11, which is gonna be X20, and I'm gonna also note that I read from memory, and I write to a new version of R11, which I'm gonna call X21, just taking the next free register on my list. So here I've written memory just as a reminder that I'm gonna need to do the conflict handling to see if, to check whether these two instructions here depend on each other somewhere later in the processor. Okay, then I have an IR move queue of 100 to R8. And you might be tempted to say, oh, okay, so R8, that's currently X18. Don't need to do that. And the reason why is IR move queue doesn't actually read from R8, and we're gonna handle that here in renaming because we don't want to have the processor wait to run the IR move queue because there's no reason to, right? If we can run the IR move queue right away, we don't need to wait for the add here to run first. So we're gonna write our IR move queue, it just writes to a new version of R8. It doesn't read from the old version. I'm not gonna write that down because later on when I figure out when I can run the IR move queue, I don't want to take into account the old version of R8, it doesn't matter. I don't need to wait for the add to run that IR move queue. And then I have this final add, so I read from R11, which is currently X21, and R8, which is currently X23, and I write to a new version of R8, for which I'll choose X24, just taking the next thing off my list of free registers. Questions? How I did that renaming? Okay, so in that case, let's do okay, who'd like more time for our first instruction? So can someone tell me, what should I do for the first instruction? Yeah.
So just looking at this MQRA and R9, so R8 is probably stored in X13.
Okay, so first thing is looking up R8, X13, okay.
And R9 is probably stored in X17, so the new round of R9 will be stored in the first free register, which is X18.
Okay, so the new R9 is X18, okay. Okay, so you want me to update our table here, so cross the first free register out, because we're going to use it. And what else? What are the other updates?
And update on the register method, R9 is the newest version of R9's promise for X18.
Okay. Update that our new version of R9 is X18, and then I have our add instruction from those lookups. Seems good to me. Any questions about this process? Okay, how about our next instruction? Any So move Q to X20. Okay, so you said, okay, we don't need to read from R10. I'm not gonna worry about what R10 was before. Sounds great. And we're not gonna worry about that, which means later on we're not gonna pay attention to that when we're figuring out when we can run this move. And what should I do to update my bookkeeping information? So change R10, anything else? I should probably scratch off X20 for my free registers. Okay, some questions? Okay, so then I have my subtract. So this should, so the subtract here, I went R10, that's currently X20. And R8, which is currently X13. And that's going to go into a new register, which I'm going to use X21 for. And since that X21 is the new value of R8, I replace R8 here. Then I have my XOR. I look up R8. Well, that's now X21. And R9 is now X18. And I need a new version of R9, which is going to be X23, I just took the next thing off the free list. And since that's the new R9, update accordingly. And I'm gonna keep going. And so this process should feel very mechanical. So like probably still a pain to implement in the hardware, especially since the hardware typically does like 4 or 5 instructions at a time in a modern processor. But you know, it's pretty a mechanical process to do this translation. So questions about sort of our renaming process? Yes?
So I missed this, but is there no issue with R8 and R11 being named to the same register?
Is there no issue with R8 and R11 being named to the same register? No, there is an issue. So probably this example is wrong. That should never have happened. Yeah, if the free register list was kept correctly, so I need to correct R11 and rename. I'll correct that sometime later today when I update this live PDF, but yes. Yeah, we should absolutely not have the same physical register used until it gets freed up by not having instructions in FIFO. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Well, it's not only a free register list, there's some register has already been taken, for example,
So the question is, why is the free register list not just like X18, 19, 20, 21? So the way the free register list is getting populated is that we're looking for what instructions have finished such that they freed up a register. So probably what we'd be looking for is, like, after this add instruction finishes, X17 shouldn't be used by any later instructions, because of how add work, how the add instruction works in assembly. So that's what we'd be looking for. And so which registers get freed just depends on what exactly the instructions that get run are. And so it's not going to be a regular pattern after things get started. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Other questions? Yeah. The question is, how would the forwarding work from the subtract to the XOR? So when we're looking at our renamed version of the registers, we're going to see that we have 21 and 21. And our logic for forwarding is going to compare those 21 and 21 and say, OK, this is a value I can forward. So that's how the forwarding is going to work. And also, our logic for figuring out when we can run the XOR is going to, we're going to look at that next. It's going to turn out we're going to have like a table with an entry for each physical register. So we're going to look up index 21 in that table and say, yep, we can run this instruction now. Does that answer your question? Question, would there have to be any stalling? So these two instructions can't run, you know, we can't start them at the same time. As far as like, can we start them right after each other? That depends on what sort of forwarding we've implemented. Typically, out of order processors will make it so we can run the subtract and in the next cycle do the XOR, just because if they don't do that, there's so many programs they'd run really slowly. Not because like necessarily you couldn't design things differently, but for typical programs, it would be really bad not to implement that case. But something like a GPU, for example, might not implement this case as fast because it's less important on GPU programs. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so talked a bit about registry naming. So there's one thing we didn't deal with, which is kind of important, which is that some of our instructions kind of have these extra hidden inputs. So for example, push and pop need the stack pointer. Jump less than equal uses condition codes, and compare uses condition codes. And we need to handle these, and these have dependencies. These create dependencies, we know. And one solution we can use to handle this, which is a very common solution, is that we can translate these instructions in the renaming step to different, simpler types of instructions. Typically more, but simpler types of instructions. So we can translate the pop. I probably should have this. Like, we can translate a pop into an add in R move Q. We can do this during our renaming step because we're translating the instructions anyways. So we can do this step there. We can translate a compare and a jump less than equal to have the condition codes be an explicit register in order so we can handle them with this renaming scheme and, you know, our register checking schemes and forwarding. So this is one way we can deal with these sort of hidden operands, is we can translate the instructions to simpler instructions, which make everything very explicit. And this is commonly what processors will do. Questions about the strategy of transforming the instructions while we're doing, since we're doing the renaming anyways, we might as well transform the instructions more if that's convenient. Okay, so we've talked about the renaming step. Let's move on to our next step, which is the instruction queue. So here we have done our renaming, we've done our translation of instructions that like use like the stack pointer to make that explicit. So we have our nice ready to run instructions. So we're gonna have a queue of instructions, and let's say I have two ALUs I can run them on. And here, I only am going to deal with ALU instructions, so I don't have to worry about like loading source. So they just aren't here. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to have a list of all my registers and whether the value of those registers is ready or not. And I'll call this a scoreboard. And I'm just going to go through my instructions. I'm going to say, okay, I have instruction one, it needs register one, that's ready. It needs register five, that's ready. We can start this instruction. So one is ready, five is ready. So we could start instruction one. I'm going to say, okay, great, let's schedule instruction one here. Same screens. Instruction two. It needs register two. That is, in fact, ready. It needs register six. That is still pending. It can't run that one. Too bad. Okay, so that's not a candidate. I'm going to look at instruction three. It needs register three. That's ready. Seven. Seven's still pending. Can't run that one. I'm going to keep going. Instruction four. It needs register four. That's ready. It needs eight. That's ready. That's not ready. Nope, can't run that one. Jump not equal, needs register nine. Well, still pending, and I keep going. Six, needs one, eight. And I'm gonna find out that even though I had this queue of tens of instructions, there's only one I can actually run. And this is a relatively common event for out of order processors, like your laptop or desktop. So I'll end up running just one instruction during the first cycle and no more, just because all the other ones don't work. So I just run the first instruction, that's it. So I have an ALU that I just couldn't use, too bad. Well, I finished the first instruction, and then I'm gonna, knowing it's done for the next cycle, I'm gonna mark register six is now ready, because it wrote to register six, that value is ready. And I'm gonna look at my instructions now and say, what can I do? So instruction two, two is ready, six is ready, I can run it. So I'm gonna say during cycle two, I'm gonna run instruction two. I'm gonna look for instruction three, three is ready, seven still not ready, four is ready, eight still not ready, and we're gonna find again, I have two places I can run instructions. Unfortunately, there's only one I can actually start right now. And that's instruction two. So we're gonna let instruction two run, and we're gonna mark register seven is ready. We're gonna repeat the process, and we're gonna run instruction three. Now we get to cycle four, and well, we check again. So we've run instruction three, we look at instruction four. Four is ready, register four. Register eight is ready now. So I can run instruction four. Okay, so I'm gonna run instruction four. I look at the jump not equal. Seven, nine is not ready, can't run that. I look at the add, one is ready. Oh, and eight is ready, I can run this. So I put in instruction six. And finally, I found an extra instruction I can run to use my second ALU. And now we'll start in this next cycle two instructions. Note that something we're doing here is that based on that conditional jump being there, that I'm running one instruction in the next iteration of the loop before I've actually evaluated whether the loop, or even started to evaluate whether the loop condition is true or not. But this is me taking advantage of branch prediction, which is what sort of why I fetched all these instructions in the first place. That's how I could fetch instructions after a J&E, so we did branch prediction. But now I finally fetched two instructions to take advantage of having two ALUs, and I did something out of order too, where I skipped over the J&E because we can't evaluate that yet, and just went on to the next iteration of the loop and started doing those calculations. So then we will look at the next, after these instructions finish, we'll look at the next instruction. We'll say, okay, now register nine, that's ready. Register two is ready. Register nine is ready. We can run these two instructions. So we're gonna start instructions five and seven. And now we get to a case where we look at our instructions here. We say, okay, register 3 is ready, register 10 is ready, and register 4 is ready, register 12 is not ready. So I only have one instruction I can run, and that's going to be instruction 8. Then I can run instruction 9. That's sort of how I end up dispatching instructions. So you see the basic process is I look through the registers the instructions read from, see if they're ready, and I just keep scanning, try to fill every single slot I have to execute instructions. And sometimes I'm going to look through all my instructions and there's nothing to put there. But hopefully I'll find something to put there, and I just keep going. And as instructions finish, I update my list of what registers are ready and repeat this process. Some questions about our instruction dispatch. Yeah.
During which stage would we know the result of the jump or not equal?
Question, during which stage would we know the result of the jump not equal? So in this design, the ALU is going to produce that result. And if we find out that the jump not equal is not actually taken, we're going to need to do a bunch of work to undo all the instructions we've partially executed that are after the jump not equal. And that's going to be so there's multiple ways that could be implemented. Sort of the simplest way is that would be the work of the commit stage. We'd have the bookkeeping information to figure out basically which are the right versions of the registers to use to go back to that point in time. Does that answer your question? Yes. When does the scoreboard get updated? So we're going to update it based on when the execution finishes, which we're going to know, which we should be able to predict most of the time based on when we dispatch the instruction. In some cases, we might need to figure out how long a load takes and get a signal back and update that. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so let's look at a case where, so as I mentioned when I talked about the execution units, broadly, often we have kind of different kinds of execution slots. So in this example, I have an ALU and a data cache, and those are kind of separate slots I can put instructions in. So what are we going to do here? I'm going to look at my instructions, I'm going to say, first instruction, we need 4, that's ready. So I can run this instruction, so I'm going to put it somewhere. I can't put it in the ALU because it needs the data cache. So it has to go in the slot for the data cache in the first cycle. I'm going to look at the second instruction. It's ready, I can run it. The problem is it needs to go in the slot for the data cache, and I've run out of slots it can go in. I can't put it in the ALU, it's not an ALU instruction. So even though that second instruction's ready, I'm not going to run it. But I'm going to keep going. I have my next instruction, this add needs register 1, register 2, those are both ready. So I can run that. I'm going to put that in the ALU because it's an ALU instruction. So that's what I run in the first cycle. Here. And then I'm going to say, okay, so that means that after I run both of these both instructions are both done. And I have register 6 and 8 ready, and then I'm going to check again for what instructions can I run. I'm going to look at the second instruction. Register 5 is still ready, so I can run that, and I'm going to put it in my data cache slot. And I'm going to check the next non-done instruction, which is instruction 4, and I say, okay, register 1's ready, register 6 is ready, therefore we can run that next. So note that when we have different kinds of slots for instructions, we have to pay attention to that when we're doing the dispatch step. Where can we actually put this instruction? And that's sometimes going to be a limitation, where in this example, our data cache can only load one thing at a time. So I needed to sort of, even though I had 2 things to load, I couldn't do them both at once, but I could do something else with the ALU. Questions on dispatch example? Yeah.
Why did it do instruction
why didn't we do instruction 2 in the first cycle? So instruction 2, if we look at it, it's an M remove Q. So it wants to go in the data cache. It can't just use the ALU. And I assigned instruction 1 to the data cache. And once I did that, I couldn't put instruction 2 there. So my assumption here is that my data cache only does one load at a time. So if my data cache did 2 loads at a time, then I'd have 2 slots and I could fill them both. And some processors do work that way, but that's, you know, not the assumption I'm making here. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah?
Is cycle 2 and the other supposed to be 4?
Is that supposed to be 4? Yes. Thank you. Instruction 4, not... So yeah, I was thinking of the register array from. Other questions? Okay. So let's talk a bit more about these execution units. So often, the execution units will have sort of multiple copies of some things and not multiple copies of others, so we'll have some specialization. And one thing about these execution units is that often they're not all things which take just one cycle to do an operation. So for example, you know, maybe we'll have an ALU that's pipelined, and will be pipelined probably because we're running things that are a lot more complicated than like an add. So for example, it's common for a multiply to be done in multiple cycles on a processor. So you might have an ALU which does multiplies in 3 cycles and might be pipelined. So the way that would work is we could put in one pair of values to multiply every cycle, we get the result 3 cycles later. So let's say that's our ALU for multiplies, you know, and we might have that ALU kind of alongside other ALUs that are like less general, that like only handle simpler operations. But let's say we have an ALU which takes 3 cycles, is pipelined for doing multiplies. How long does it take to compute this value? Or an alternate question, if that question seems a little daunting, is what's our first step for computing this value using that ALU? Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks it should be 6 cycles? 7 cycles? Okay, 8 cycles? 9 cycles? 10 or more cycles? Less than 6 cycles? Okay, so we have some divergence, but plurality on 9. So I would say 9 cycles, because what we're going to have to do, based on what I wrote here, is our first step is we're going to compute C times D. We're going to do stage 1 of that, stage 2 of that, then stage 3 of that. And then we're going to be able to compute Z. that value, b times that value. And we're going to have to start that after stage 3 because we don't have the value to multiply by. Stage 1, stage 2, stage 3, and then we're going to do a times that value, and that's going to be another stage 1, 2, 3. This gives us 9 cycles. Now, some of you who came up with 7 or 6 might have said, wait a moment, this is stupid. Why did you write it like that? Shouldn't you have written A times B times C times D? Yes, I should have. It's not what I did. It's probably a better choice because with this, what we could do is we can do A times B and we can start C times D while we can do stage 1 of C times D while we're doing stage 2 of A times B. And so things will run faster. So here's a case where it matters exactly what we're computing, but here the parentheses are saying, I was explicitly saying to do it the bad way. So I get, in this case, 9 cycles. Questions? Okay. So we all can have execution units which kind of like are pipeline like this. Another thing we might have are things which take variable amounts of time but are unpipelined. So for example, division often is implemented in a way where it takes a variable number of steps, or the data cache. And while this will work is we'll have like the execution unit will have some signal which tells us when it's done. That's going to help us, you know, handle our scoreboard and our instruction queue, and also, you know, let us know when to do the write back and so on. So one question might be, we need to think about how does our instruction queue work when we have things that take multiple cycles. So here I'm going to say we have 2 ALUs that are kind of general purpose, and we have a 2-stage multiply. So we have a pipeline multiply that takes 2 stages. We're going to think about how the dispatch works here. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to look for instructions to run, and I'm going to find, thinking of what's ready, I'm going to find I can only start 2 instructions, and those 2 instructions are going to be this first add, if I'm going from the beginning, and this first multiply. I'm going to put the first multiply on, you know, start it in cycle 1, and that means it's going to finish in cycle 2. So that means when I get to my next cycle 2 and I'm looking at what to run, this is the scenario I have, that even though I already started the thing that writes to register 6, on my scoreboard it's still pending because it hasn't finished yet. It's not going to be ready until cycle 3, and I'm going to need to take that into account when I'm doing my instruction dispatch. Even though I've started the thing that computes that, it's not done yet, I need to know that, and not start running things that need that register 6. But I am actually, in this case, going to find 2 instructions I can start. So that's what I'm going to do. So I'm going to start those 2 instructions, including a multiply that, again, I'm going to say it starts during cycle 3 while the first multiply is finishing, and it's going to finish during, sorry, starts during cycle 2, is going to finish during cycle 3. Well, it's going to start while the first multiply is finishing. And then, during cycle 3, I'm going to finally have updated register 6, the one written by our multiply we started. Finally, I have that marked as ready, so I can finally, you know, consider this instruction 7 as something I can start. But that's sort of the bookkeeping I need to do. So I need to pay attention when I have these multi-cycle multipliers or other execution units, but I can't mark the registers as ready right after I dispatch the instruction. I need to wait until it actually finishes, you know, by tracking how long it takes. Some questions about how our sort of more complex execution units change this dispatch logic? you know, I guess I note in this case, because we just computed the value, we just started computing the value of register 8, we can't actually run instruction 4 yet. Even though it's kind of influence. Okay. So when looking at our examples of how instruction dispatch works, one thing that we've noticed is that, at least in my examples, and this is actually a thing which comes up in real programs a lot, is that we can't always find things to run. Even though we might have lots of places to put instructions and a big list of potential instructions, including branch predictions, so it's from like lots of iterations of a loop, it often turns out that all the instructions we have depend on things that aren't done yet. And this is something that programmers can help with. So we're going to look at how programmers can help with that. And a convenient model for this is something called the data flow model. So rather than like keeping track of the instruction queue precisely, I'm going to have this like very rough approximation where I'm going to sort of have ovals that represent our instructions. I'm going to have arrows going to them to represent their inputs and coming out of them to represent their outputs. And looking at this diagram, we can kind of see quickly, oh, based on this, we have three things we can run at once, because they, in this diagram, clearly are kind of independent of each other. So we can estimate that if we have the execution units, we have the ALUs, the data cache that has enough inputs and so on, we can do three operations per cycle based on this. And probably more importantly, we can see we have this kind of chain of dependencies here. And in order to complete this operation, we have to do these one at a time. We can't do the second add here until the first one finishes. We can't do the third one until the second one finishes. If we think of our instruction queue, we're only going to be able to dispatch one of these adds at a time. We have to wait for the next to finish, even if they're all in our queue. And this sort of longest chain, our textbook calls a critical path. And the amount of time we need to run this program is at least enough time to run one add, followed by another add, followed by another add. We can't do these adds in parallel. We have to do them one after another. And that's going to sort of limit our runtime. And this is the phenomenon we were seeing when I did our loop unrolling example last time, where we found out, oh, I did lots of loop unrolling, and I was down to one cycle per instruction. That one cycle is that I have to do one add, then the next add, then the next add. And even though my processor had lots of adders, didn't matter, we had to do the adds sort of sequentially because of this dependency setup. And also, this kind of reveals why my more loop unrolling didn't help. When we think of our loop unrolling, what we were doing is we were reducing some kind of these bookkeeping operations, like checking the loop bounds. And those aren't part of that sort of longest chain. And if we can do four things at once, it doesn't really matter. Like, we aren't changing how much work we have to do. We look at this data flow diagram. But if we just have a little extra capacity, we can easily squeeze those in, and they don't affect our longest chain. So as for fixing this, we kind of saw the example earlier. So let's do that with just a slightly changed numbers. So we have five cycle multiplier. How long do each of these versions take? So we have the version with the bad parentheses, the version with the good parentheses. And so most of you figured this out last time. A good way of helping figure this out is to draw that diagram. That give us a rough idea of what happens. Okay. Here I'm assuming a 5 cycle instead of 3 cycle. Let's start with the one on the left. So who thinks this is 10 cycles? 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, more than 15, less than 10. Okay, we have pretty good consensus that this is 15. And the reason why is we have to do this multiply, then this multiply, then this multiply. And even though we have a pipeline multiplier, we can't take advantage of that. We have to do one, all the stages of one, then all the stages of the other. So we're wasting 4/5 of our multiplier's capacity. Okay, so how about the example on the right? So who thinks that's going to be 10 cycles? 11 cycles? More than 11 cycles? Less than 10 cycles? No idea? Okay, so we have a slip between 10 and 11. So 10 is the bound we get by saying, oh, we either have to do this, then this, that multiply, then that multiply, or this multiply, then this multiply. So that tells us it has to be at least 10 cycles. But that's kind of a lower bound. Here we run into a bit of a problem, which is what we want to do is we want to, say, compute A times B. So that's going to be stage 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And we want to also compute C times D. But we have a single multiplier here. We only have one. Then we can't start the C times D and the A times B at the same time. We have to wait a cycle. So we end up, you know, the most efficient way we can do it is we can start stage 1 of C times D, you know, during stage 2 of A times B. And so that means we finish A times B and C times D in 6 cycles, not 5, because we have to spend an extra cycle to start C times D, and then we can do the 5 cycles for multiplying those two things together. And that gives us 11 cycles. Questions? How I got that answer? So we can see the data flow doesn't give us kind of the exact answer, but it's a pretty good approximation. Now, applying this idea, we can, and this idea that, oh, we want to find multiple things to do at once, we can apply this actually to our original sum example. So here's a better way of doing that sum. So what I'm doing is I'm doing two partial sums and adding them together at the end. And if I think of this, you know, our reading this picture here, one thing I see is, oh, I have 6 kind of things I can do at once. Yeah. That seems a lot better. You know, that I have more things that seem independent of each other. And if I look at sort of my longest path, it's about 4 adds to do 4 adds of, you know, in the longest path, but I'm actually doing 7 additions. In total, maybe 6 of which are useful. And we can think of, so this should be more efficient for doing the same number of actual additions of work. And we can think of writing this out as code. And this idea is called multiple accumulator. So I have a place where I'm accumulating a value, like a sum or a product. And rather than having one place to accumulate it, I accumulate to multiple places and combine them at the end. And the advantage of this is I've exposed a way of doing more things at once, where previously, because of my dependency between, you know, each successive operation, they had to happen one at a time. Now they can happen in parallel. So now this loop, if my processor has a whole bunch of adders, it can do both of these adds at the same time, whereas previously that wasn't possible. Previously, it had to do one, then the other, because they used the same sum variable. So questions on this multiple accumulators transformation? What we did? Yes?
So does this form of code help with, like, bookkeeping that we discussed last class as well as?
Question, does this help with the bookkeeping? So in the sense of, like, should I do this for I is what your question is? Or? Okay, so the question is, how does this interact with loop unrolling? So I can't really do this if I don't do loop unrolling first. Right? I wouldn't have exposed the way to have two separate variables in a convenient way if I didn't do loop unrolling first. So this is generally something we'll do after we also do loop unrolling. Does that answer your question? Okay. Good question. Yeah. Other questions? Yeah, so this is something that we kind of need to do with loop unrolling or else it won't make sense. And, well, so you might say, how does this perform? So I ran this. So I did the same example before, and I started with my 16 copies of the loop body unrolled version, and I added this multiple accumulator. So I have one accumulator, it's just the original 16 unrolled version. So there's just one sum variable. I had two sum variables, so sum 1 and sum 2, 4, 8, and 16. And 16 is the most I can do with the 16 copies of the loop body because, well, then I ran out of plus equals operations to change the sum variable on. These are the performance numbers I got. So you can see that it dramatically helped my performance, and then it plateaued. So, and then it got worse. So let's talk about why it plateaued. So it plateaued because, well, my machine can only do so many ads at a time. So that's one reason it plateaued. And we ran into that limit. So now I'm at the limit where, you know, I just can't do more ads. You might say, wait a moment, shouldn't that be 0.5, not 0.57? We'll get to that later. Why is it 0.57 instead of 0.5? But it plateaued because it has a limit of how many ads at a time. Now, why did it start getting worse? What happens here? And as a hint, can someone tell me how many registers do we have in assembly in x86-64, general purpose registers? And, yeah. 16, so that's the number of general purpose registers I have. That's related to what happened here. Why did it get worse? So what was happening? Yeah. Question, did it have to start backing up registers somewhere else? Yes, so my compiler, you know, with 8 registers in accumulators, it could store all the sums in different registers. With 16, it started generating code that like copied it to the stack and back or similar. And that's just more cache accesses, it's slower. It's more, both more instructions and like pretty complex instructions because we're reading from the cache and writing to the cache. So it ended up getting slower at 16 just because the compiler ran out of registers, used the stack, that's more work. And also, we didn't have more adders to use anyway, so it couldn't help performance because we couldn't find more adds to do. You know, we already filled up all the slots we had in the processor. We didn't have, you know, 10 slots for adds in my laptop. We only have probably 4. Questions about, yeah. So then I promise I get to the mystery of, you know, why did it at 2, are we at 0.57 and not 0.5? So 0.5 is what you'd expect if we're doing 2 ads per cycle. So each element takes half a cycle, you know, if we take the average. But it's 0.57. And a way we can figure this out is I just looked at the assembly code and counted the instructions. So we have 2 additions for each element. Why 2? Well, 1 to deal with the indexing into A, and 1 to deal with the actual sum. We had, on each iteration of the loop, we had 3 add, subtract, and compares for the bookkeeping, plus a branch instruction for in the loop. And you know, the loop handled 16 elements, so we had 3/16 plus 1/16 of them. Of those bookkeeping instructions per element. Just saying this, you know, 16 elements handled by loop, 4 of those instructions. So that ends up being a quarter of instruction of bookkeeping for every element that we needed. So my loop was running 2 1/4 instructions per element. And these were approximately the instructions we would have after renaming. And on my laptop, it turns out the way the out-of-order pipeline is built, it can do the renaming step. It can only do so many instructions at a time. It can do about 4 per cycle. The decoding step that like handles, you know, processing the machine code and converting it to something the renaming step can use, it can do 4 to 6 per cycle. It can, the committing step can do 4 instructions per cycle. The ALUs can handle 4 operations per cycle. If I take 2 1/4 instructions per cycle, divide by 4, I get 0.57. So my loop overhead, that fourth, that started mattering now that I had exposed more operations to do in parallel. And that's why I had 0.57 and not 0.5. That means I could do more unrolling and get that 0.57 down closer to 0.5. So that's where we're going to finish up this time. Next Tuesday, we don't have class because of Election Day. Next Wednesday, we have a lab which is going to be on loop unrolling and multiple accumulators.